You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Monday Old Mole Variety Hour. You just heard the beginning of a song by Canadian singer-songwriter Bruce Cockburn and his 1987 song Waiting for a Miracle. I'm sorry we couldn't hear much of that, but it was written in Managua, Nicaragua, after observing the impact of years of the U.S.-created Contra Wars against the Sandinista government. At the time, he noted that since his first visit, quote, the revolution was getting tired, not hopeless, but tired. Back in the 1980s, the U.S. government and mainstream corporate media portrayed rebellions in Central America as communist-inspired to justify military interventions, in the case of Nicaragua, and support for brutal military regimes in the case of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Our next guest, James Phillips, reminds us of the legacy of those U.S. policies and how they continue in Nicaragua and Honduras. Phillips recently retired as affiliate professor of anthropology and international studies at Southern Oregon University. He has worked in and written about Central America since the 1970s, and acts as an expert witness in the asylum cases of Hondurans in U.S. immigration hearings. He has published many articles and book chapters on Central American immigrants and refugees, popular resistance movements, and the relationship of the U.S. to Central American countries, and is the author of the 2015 book, Honduras in Dangerous Times, Resistance and Resilience, and a recent piece that appeared in NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America, entitled Complicating the Narrative About Nicaragua. Welcome to KBOO, Jim.
Thank you.
So tell us what is missing in the current reporting on Nicaragua, which has been very critical of President Daniel Ortega.
Well, there's a lot to be critical of. I mean, Ortega is certainly not a perfect person, and his rule has not, in the past 2 years at least, has, you know, is open to criticism for sure. The issue, though, is that this latest conflict in Nicaragua, which began in April or so, which really flared up in April, is not simply one that the media has portrayed as a, you know, a brutal dictator and a very peaceful resistance movement trying to overthrow a brutal dictatorship. It's much more complicated than that, and most of the mainstream media has really not dealt with the complications of that at all. And by complications, I mean just a little bit of the history of the way in which the United States, for example, as one of the many actors in Nicaragua, has attempted over many, many years, since at least the 1980s, to overthrow, to deal with, to sideline, to destroy the Sandinista movement, and specifically Daniel Ortega, who's been one of the major figures that Washington has never liked. And the reason for that, of course, is because in the 1970s, the Sandinista movement and Ortega as part of it overthrew the 45-year dictatorship of the Somoza family, which the U.S. governments had supported, Democrats and Republicans, for many years, for 45 years. And I think that our people in Washington, our governments, the U.S. has never quite forgiven the Sandinistas or Ortega for, or the people of Nicaragua for that matter, for overthrowing a brutal dictatorship which we had supported.
And it's not just the mainstream corporate media that's been leaving out that the role of, or the longtime role of, the U.S. in intervening in Nicaragua and Central America, but also human rights groups like Amnesty International left out important information about other factors that are leading to this kind of violence and the protests in Nicaragua.
Yeah, a lot of what's left out is any question about whether there are any other interests involved in the current conflict. That is, others, outsiders or other Nicaraguan groups, perhaps, who are interested in their own agendas and furthering their own agendas in the current situation. There are students, of course, it was portrayed as a student-led movement to begin with. The current conflict that started in April and it was portrayed largely as a peaceful street movement. But there have for many years been organizations in Nicaragua, the Civic Youth Movement, funded by the National Democratic Institute, which is related to the National Endowment for Democracy. All of these are funded and related to the United States government and in part to the CIA. There's a history between the National Endowment for Democracy and the CIA. And as we can see and say, not only in Nicaragua itself during the 1980s, during the Nicaraguan Revolution, but in many other countries, Guatemala, Chile, even Jamaica, has been involved in, shall we say, regime change against governments that it didn't like, that we didn't like. And so there's that. There's the U.S. involvement itself, and it's been there for many years. And it's always phrased as promoting democracy in Nicaragua. The question is, what do we mean by democracy? Does that mean, do we want regime change or what? Then there are other issues as well. A lot of, quite a few people that I've talked to when I was there during the past year talk about opposition in other forms. Organized gangs who've come from El Salvador. Nicaragua is the only Central American country which does not have, at this time, a serious drug problem or a serious gang problem, in part because of the way that the Sandinista police have, the government police have dealt with these things in a community-oriented way. But the organized crime, drugs and narcos related in Guatemala, Honduras in particular, and El Salvador, may well have an interest in penetrating that and getting into Nicaragua. I should point out, so there's that, there's organized criminal activity that, some of the observers that I've talked to seem to see. There are also, these demonstrations were not as nearly as peaceful as some of the. The mainstream media has always pointed out that, it keeps saying that the government, the police, the Nicaraguan police, and the government has used all the violence against peaceful demonstrators. The reality is that these peaceful demonstrators are mixed up a great deal with non-peaceful demonstrators. With gang protesters, with others who have their own interests in mind. There's been a lot of talk about the way that people have been killed, including Sandinista officials and all as well. So that part of the story doesn't get told.
And there's also the question of student involvement in the conflict, which is more complex. Not all students, yeah. Not all young people are protesting against the Sandinistas, or at least for the reasons that the National Endowment for the for Democracy and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio would like to think.
Right. Yeah, there is a lot of, some of these students have been, this is Nicaragua. Nicaragua is different from the rest of Central America in some ways, partly, largely because of the revolution of the 1970s and early 80s and what they went through with the Contra War in the 1980s. There's a great deal of, young people in Nicaragua have been well trained in the question of resistance to any kind of dictatorship and repression. So the Nicaraguan people themselves, the Sandinistas and all, have trained their own youth, their own students, their own people, these generations, to resist these things. And so it's natural that if they see, problems with the Nicaraguan government, with Ortega and sort of a heavy-handed dictatorship there, that they would resist that. The problem, though, is that this kind of resistance, which in itself is what people do and should do to promote democracy, is also co-opted by the United States and by outside interests for their own purposes, which are mostly non-democratic.
And there's always been a high level of hypocrisy in U.S. policy around the world, but especially directed at Latin America, where figures like Ortega or Lula in Brazil or Maduro in Venezuela, who, although flawed and problematic, are all branded as dictators violating human rights, when at the same time, the U.S. repeatedly supports actual brutal dictators and anti-democratic military regimes, such as in Honduras. What's with this double standard?
Well, I do a lot of work in Honduras, and that's one of the places that I'm currently involved with, you know, working and studying what happens in Honduras, and I've been doing that for many years. Today in Honduras, we actually do have a brutal dictatorship. Washington has accused Ortega in Nicaragua of getting himself reelected illegally in the last elections that were held. Well, that happened in Honduras a year later, last year actually, in a much more brutal way, a much more violent way actually. And the U.S. Congress and members of our own administration, the State Department, said, wonderful, that's a great democracy at work in Honduras, which has a death, a murder rate somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 per 100,000 people. Nicaragua's murder rate under the Sandinista government has been somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 per 100,000, the lowest in the area in the region by far, one of the lowest ones in the hemisphere. So it's a much more peaceful country until these demonstrations occurred. There's a whole list of things about Nicaragua that we could say that people don't know, that under the Sandinista government have been great improvements in a lot of ways in the lives of people in Nicaragua, including the use, for example, of sustainable energy. They've become a leader in the hemisphere, actually, in that. We don't hear about that very much. This is not to say that, you know, that Ortega should be, that we should all support Daniel Ortega. This is not for the United States to decide, or for me to decide, or for us to decide. It's for the people of Nicaragua to decide who they want. The problem is that it is extremely complicated. There are many different factions in Nicaragua. We need to understand that.
And also that the U.S. was involved in the coup in Honduras during the Obama administration. And let's turn to that. You know, you draw this important comparison between Nicaragua and surrounding countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, which are suffering extreme levels of violence. And, of course, that violence originates in U.S. interventions in the 70s and 80s. But let's talk a bit about Honduras before we run out of time here. And since Hondurans make up the majority of migrants making up the caravan seeking asylum at the U.S. border, what is behind the high numbers of Hondurans fleeing that country?
Well, there's a history of our using Honduras as our base, you know, to control the rest of Central America. That goes way back again to at least the 1980s, 1970s, really. We used, in fact, Honduras was the base from which we engineered the coup d'etat in Guatemala in 1954, which led to many years of genocide in that country. Honduras has always been that base. But what's happened more recently, in 2009, there was a coup d'etat that overthrew a democratically elected president. And that coup d'etat, which was certainly illegal and unconstitutional in the Honduran context, has led to a series of governments that now, the current government is, Hondurans call it a dictatorship. It has reelected itself illegally twice now. And there's a lot of concern about that. But the real issue in Honduras today, and the major reason why people flee this country, is because they're displaced. And they're displaced for two reasons. One is poverty, and the other is violence. And all of that stems in large part from the models of development, economic development, in a country like Honduras, which is rich in minerals. We have American, U.S. companies, Canadian companies, and European companies, and the Chinese, who are extracting hundreds of thousands of tons of all kinds of ores, antimony, iron ore, gold, etc., from Honduras, a country rich in these minerals. And what all of that does is all these things are done with the blessing of the Honduran government, ignoring all the rights of local communities. And so local communities are displaced because mining and logging and tourism and all these industries displace communities. They destroy environments. They don't observe, they don't need to observe any rules or regulations. They don't need to get permission from anybody, from any of the local people, which they're supposed to do according to the law. And all of that displaces communities, creates unemployment, uproots people, and contributes to poverty. Honduras is now considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, even ahead of Haiti. So poverty alone, and when people are poor, their right, human rights, are often denied and ignored. We know that even in our own country. So that has led and fed to the poverty is fed gang violence and a bunch of other things. On top of which, there's a great deal of corruption in the Honduran government, and that's been documented again and again and again. I won't go into the details of that. So a combination of a corrupt government, an illegal government, an oppressive government, poverty and violence are enough to push people to leave the country. They can't survive in its conditions anymore.
And that is such an important piece missing from all of the media coverage and human rights organizations' accounts about what is happening in Honduras Nicaragua. James Phillips, thank you so much for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour today. And we need to have you return at some point in the future to continue this discussion about U.S. policy.
Be happy to.
And in Thank Honduras you. And Nicaragua and the violence that is pushing so many people to migrate.
Be glad to do that. Thank you.